at close to the speed of light. You would get two very different distances, very different velocities. You're starting to get the relativistic effects of the speed of light. There could very well be a relativistic effect when it comes to the speed of sound. Now, if the emitter was moving and I'm sitting still, I'm going to hear a continuous tone that shifted in frequency. And if the detector is moving, instead of the emitter moving, again, I'm going to hear a continuous tone. But now the detector and the emitter are sitting still, but the air is moving. And that's creating a phase shift of the continuous tone. So that's a kind of Doppler phase shift instead of Doppler frequency shift because of the air moving at some velocity slow compared to the speed of sound. If you allow me now to let the air start moving at close to the speed of sound, let's assume now that I've got the emitter at the nose of the airplane. Let me put the emitter at the tail of the airplane and the detector at the nose of the airplane. Let me drop. So outside of the fuselage of the airplane, on the vertical stabilizer, at the nose of the airplane, I've got a detector. So the tail is continuously sending out a tone, the nose is continuously receiving the tone, and I now fly the airplane faster and faster. I know I'm going to get a significant phase shift. As the airplane approaches the speed of sound, that emitter coming out of the vertical stabilizer never gets to the nose of the airplane. The sound stops entirely. Okay. Just before the sound stops entirely, tell me what frequency you're going to hear. KC2WGB, K2REW with more elaborate experiments.
Okay, I agree with you so far. As long as there's no acoustic coupling between the tail and the nose, we have a perfect isolator. As we approach, once we hit the speed of sound, that wave will never hit the receiver. So now, does that mean the faster we go, we're elongating that wave and making the frequency go lower and lower as we speed up? Is that what you're saying?
I know that the sound goes from getting from the tail to the nose at less than the speed of sound velocity. The sound is getting there, but the phase is continuously being shifted. And as you approach the speed of sound, all of a sudden the sound doesn't get there at all. In between hearing a continuous tone and hearing nothing, guaranteed it's some kind of a transition where the tone that you hear, although it's getting weaker, is going to be higher in frequency, lower in frequency. We're starting to get into the relativistic effects here of the speed of sound. I can't believe that there's some magic velocity at which a beautiful tone is getting there and it very suddenly stops. Mother Nature doesn't do that. There's going to be some kind of a transition. And in that transition, what is the receiver in the nose going to hear on that outside airstream of that airplane? We ain't got an answer, but I think we're getting more of the ingredients of the problem. I don't think the problem is simple. How about you, John? What else is new? K2IW, you got it, John.
KC2WGB. Damn these questions. These are fun. Well, we could basically say the same thing. We could put the two persons doing the experiment on a sled, and one could be making the noise, the other one is hearing it. Okay, the sled's 100 feet long. And we send that sled through the air at increasing speeds. That would be basically the same. We have a fixed distance between them. And would there be a change? And then I compare that to ringing a bell underwater with the current flowing toward the south, the bell is at the north, and someone underwater in the southern location, that water as it is flowing quickly but steadily at, let's say, 10 miles an hour, would you have a phase shift, a Doppler shift, a frequency shift? Interesting stuff to think about, Dick. But, again, we'll do some more thinking and we'll come back.
Yeah, I think we gotta go back to the books on this one, John. And what Howard has brought to our attention suddenly realizes that there's a lot more going on here. Howard, from your recollection on this anemometer, was there more than one detector in two different directions? I mean, would the machine be able to tell how fast the wind is flowing? Yes. tell if the wind is flowing from the north at some speed versus flowing from the east at some speed. How to determine direction of wind flow as well as speed of wind flow if you happen to know how it. KC2OJO, wait for the beep, K2LIW in the TechNet, and Howard, thank you for bringing this to our attention.
KC2OJO. Generally, there are three or four in a triangle or a quadrilateral type configuration. Once you have multiple sensors, transceivers transmitting to each other, you can resolve the vector direction to probably a degree or two, just with ordinary trigonometry, by knowing how the phase is being actually changing for the different directions, and that gives you the direction of the wind speed. I happen to have a folder, and I can see I have a record of about five patents that are called either ultrasonic anemometer or... or fluid flow measuring apparatus.
Ultrasonic anemometer. And I can see a huge advantage here, Rich and Howard, and that is a real anemometer has got a rotating piece of machinery, which eventually is going to break down. The bearing is going to wear out. It's going to get dust and ice and everything and water inside of it. This thing now is operating by acoustics, and except for ice caking on it, and maybe even that it can tolerate, but it's properly designed, this thing has essentially no moving parts. Therefore, it can survive a hell of a lot more adverse conditions. This thing that you're describing, Howard, I believe it would properly be designed to survive in the Arctic or the Antarctic, whereas an ordinary anemometer in the Arctic with ice buildup, I think would be a bit of a nightmare. Although this thing is a little bit more expensive, I think it has potentially greater accuracy and greater adverse weather condition survivability. I'll bet you the original manufacturer made some of those claims. Is that true, Howard? KC2OJO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
The patents all basically talk about the advantage of not having mechanical parts and rotating parts. I could give you about five patent numbers. They're older ones. The oldest is 4174630. The next one is 4320666. There is 4890488. And there is 5343744. So there's been a lot of work in this field, and they use not only the ultrasonic is sometimes a carrier, and the ultrasound will be modulated, and you'll look at time differences in the modulation phase.
They also make them in hot wire anemometers too, Dick.
Yeah, hot wire is another nice way of going. When it comes to simple airflow, I wouldn't trust a hot wire anemometer in the ice flow. When you get rime ice flowing in the Antarctic, I wouldn't trust that one. John, go ahead.
No, I understand. I just wanted to point out that they make so many different types and all have their advantages. Usually the hot wires are used in ductwork.
And compared to the Antarctic, that's a very friendly environment. But I see the advantage of this thing, the ultrasonic anemometer. I'm going to look up these patents, and that gives me some ideas. So the phase shift of the audio, subcarrier. You can have a audio carrier and put subcarriers on it and measure the phase shift of either the carrier or the subcarriers as a method of measuring wind speed, and by multiple detectors and emitters displaced in a triangular or a square pattern, you now can add and subtract those vectors and figure out the exact angle of arrival and the exact velocity of the air. Beautiful technique. So I think there's not going to be a shift in frequency. I'm positive there's going to be a shift in phase. That's what I think this thing is measuring. And until you get to relativistic speeds, that airplane with the emitter at the tail and the detector at the nose moving at close to the speed of sound, we're going to have to study that one a little bit more, John. Back to you. I think that was the last of our mailbag. And we're going to go over to Paul right now, WS2N. Let me drop it.
Maybe we could get Steve, YHY, on the UHF, and we could ask him. He might have some opinions on that, Dick.
In other words, are you saying that he has worked with ultrasonic circuits? John, go ahead.
Not sure, but he's got a lot of experience, and he's very science-minded, as you know.
The Steve we're talking about, KA2YHY, teaches physics at Hofstra University. So he's heavily involved in physics. He teaches the subject. Now, Paul, is anything exciting going to come on this week? You know damn well the answer is yes. On Tuesday night, we're going to start getting pictures very slowly, in my opinion, from the New Horizons spacecraft as it goes whizzing by what used to be a planet called Pluto. And all of the data being downlinked on that huge number of miles is going to... Take a significant number of days, maybe as much as 160 days, for all of the data it records, all of those pictures and other data recordings to be downloaded. So I think I'm hearing people telling me that we're starting to already see some higher resolution pictures of Pluto as the spacecraft approaches Pluto. WS2N with the Space Report. Space Report number 157, I believe. K2IW with TechNet. You've got a poll.
This is WS2N. And, yeah, I mean, quite often I'm getting email alerts from the app I have, I think it's the best app going, Pluto Safari. I mentioned it at the end of the net when we were running out of time last week. But they send you email updates. Well, not email, but, you know, updates, and you bring up the app and hit news, and they'll tell you the latest news, the pictures. In fact, about an hour ago, I just got a nice, pretty detailed picture of Charmin, the moon that's going around Pluto. I've seen up Pluto. One looks like they have a big heart next to it. Another one looks like a whale at the bottom of Pluto, and now the details are starting to come in every couple of hours, I guess. So it's going to be interesting to see the close view, the closest view of Pluto. Pictures are at least going to be released right away. A lot of the data, there's 7 instruments on board. It's going to take a lot of time to get all the pictures and all the data back. And like you said, I saw one that said 88 days. And another report I saw a year. I find that a little hard to believe, but maybe that's possible, depending on the data rate. So a couple of notes. The Science Channel on the 15th, the day after this happened, is going to have a one-hour show. A little longer than that, from 10 o'clock p.m. to 11:02. If you have cable vision like I have, it's channel 170. It's called Direct from Pluto, so they'll have all the latest news, what happened, what's going to happen. And another show that's going to be put on is that night. It's happening on July 14th. And it's actually happening in the morning in New York, New York time, Eastern Standard Time. It's 7:49 and 57 seconds. So 10 minutes to 8 in the morning, and we'll start to get information coming back on how they're doing. Well, we'll be getting information even now, you know, they're getting better pictures. Like I said, every hour or two, something else is coming in. So National Geographic Channel 162, and that would be on that day, July 14th at 9 p.m., 9 to 10. That's Eastern Standard Time. So I already set the recorder. We'll see what it looks like. I'm sure it'll be on every news station, CNN, Channel 2 News, 4, 12. Something that's taken almost 10 years, 9.5 years. You mentioned the launch date was January 19th, 2006. I had a UTC time there. It was 1900s. I think that was like, I don't know, 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That 9.5 years ago, they launched it on the Atlas rocket, the biggest configuration with 5 solid boosters attached to it. And that sent it off very quick. It took 9 hours to course the path of the moon and got all the way out to Pluto in 9.5 years. Instead of probably 12 or 14 years with a less powerful rocket or a heavier spacecraft. This thing only weighs a little over a couple of thousand pounds. It's as big as a piano. And it should be good. There's one guy, Alan Stern. He's a principal investigator. He's been involved with this project right from the beginning, and my guess is I'll probably see him on one of those channels describing what they did and what they expect to see. So we'll see what happens. So many other things going on in the rocket world. You have the Mars Curiosity, riding around on Mars the list. Couple of years since August 2012, they've had problems with the wheels, and I saw one picture come in of Curiosity with a large hole on the wheel. I mean, this thing looks like about an inch and a half, almost in diameter. So they've had some problems with it. Even so, the spacecraft weighs a little over 2,000 pounds. The rover before it left Earth, it's one third that weight, so probably 600 or so pounds. Still a heavy thing riding around on Mars, and with these metal wheels, it's punching holes through the wheels, so they have to carefully figure out the path as they go, and the goal is to get all the way into an up part of Mount Sharp, and using a cameras on board, navigation cameras, and they're also using the high-rise camera from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter that's in orbit around Mars to look for very good paths for Curiosity to get point A to point B on a daily basis. It only moves at like an inch and a half per second. That's about the top speed, so interesting what's going on there. Another, we cover all the launches here, Dick, so I even cover the ones from India. About the one that, they really get very good over there. They sent their spacecraft called MOM to Mars recently, and they do quite a few launches with the polar space launch vehicle. They've launched 30 of these things over the years, since the 1990s. They're getting more and more successful, and they just put up a series of satellites, 3 identifications for Britain. They're going to monitor the Earth and all, but an interesting one that, there were two other smaller ones that went up, and on that same launch, it went into a polar orbit, over the poles. This particular satellite I found interesting because it was constructed partially by an amateur radio group in Britain, and they had it transmitting on 2 meters. Frequency was 145.9950, and it was coming out, you know, digital, 1200 bits per second. And after launching from India, an amateur from Oregon, this guy Ken W7KKE, he first picked it up and sent the information back to India. And later on, BU3TYG from India also picked it up. So they know that was successful. And what this is a satellite, you know, one of these very small satellites, but then it opens up the space to, you know, 16 by 16, you know, they call it a 4 meter by 4 meter aluminum. And the idea of this is to show that it could create enough drag to bring space junk back. So this is a, you know, a test type of thing that they built. They want to see how it works. Depending on the mass of a spacecraft, you could, you know, send these things up and attach it to the spacecraft, open it up, and there's a rarefied atmosphere at some of the altitudes, and there's tons of, literally tons of junk flying around in space. And one of the goals is to eventually deorbit this stuff, and that's what this group in Britain had in mind. You know, let's see how it works. That's what they're doing. They're testing this. They opened it up and they want to see how long it takes to deorbit it. And, you know, you do the math and you can figure out how big of a drag type of sail do you need to bring back like a piece of space junk. There's over 5,000 tons. I mean, you can take 5,000 small cars, put them up in space all over the place. 5,000 tons over that of stuff flying around in space and occupying usable orbits that we could be using. So because of the amateur radio group that was involved with this, I thought that would be an interesting thing to bring up on the net. So there's other missions. OSIRIS-REx is going up soon in 2016. Elon Musk, he gave a speech on the Falcon 9. An interview, and they're still looking for, and then recently, the other day, he gave the interview, and they're still looking for the cause of why they think the second stage oxygen tank blew, and they have, right now, it looks like they have no idea what caused it, so they've got dozens of flights on the manifest, you know, not only for NASA and the military, and for foreign countries, foreign companies that they can't send up, they're grounded. I mean, you know, this is a form of revenue for SpaceX. And out of it, they're grounded. Here we go. We basically have right now no spacecraft from the United States that can go up and resupply the International Space Station. You know, we have foreign countries that can do it, but right now we can't. Meanwhile, NASA just picked the four astronauts that will be involved with not only SpaceX, but with Boeing. Both companies are developing in the short term to be able to send American astronauts up from American soil, you know, probably by 2017. They've now assigned these astronauts, and very well, you know, experienced astronauts, ones that I read about, that are going to work closely with SpaceX and with Boeing to complete the development, eventually fly on these spacecraft in a not too distant future. Dick, I'll turn it back to you. Any questions from you or anybody else? And if anybody wants to reach me, I can be reached at my call letters, WS2N@ARRL.net. And we'll turn it back to you, Dick. I know Pluto's the main topic, but these other topics have to be covered as well, I think. K2RIW, WS2N.
Paul, on a couple of your space reports, you reported that the New Horizons spacecraft was either the fastest or one of the fastest spacecraft we have ever launched. It may have been the fastest launch we've ever made. I'm about to pass that back to you for a correction on that. Now, because of the gravity assist that Voyager received as it flew by Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, I think it had gravity assist from all four of those, or at least three of them, it ended up moving at the fastest speed, ultimately, for that distance out. But when it comes to a pure Earth launch velocity, I think New Horizons was the fastest. That's the reason it got there in X number of years rather than X plus two more years, so to speak. And is that true? And we never launched anything any faster than New Horizons as far as velocity in the near-Earth vicinity. WS2N, K2LAW.
That's the best way to put it because, you know, some of the spacecraft, you know, get out to, let's say, Jupiter, and ones that we put into orbit around Jupiter, and they're really moving, you know. Once you get into that gravitational field, you know, 80,000 miles an hour or something. But, you know, you lose all that once you're going to go into Helios orbit, which is everything really is in. But, things start to slow down. Voyagers did that. They got the gravity assist from you know, Jupiter and Mars, Uranus, and Neptune. The thing with Uranus and Neptune is only Voyager 1 got the assist. Voyager 2 wound up, they needed better pictures of Titan, so they put on a trajectory that was different than Voyager 1. So, you know, we only have one Voyager that passed Uranus and Neptune. The other one finished up with Saturn and Titan. But right now, both Voyagers are in the 40,000 mile bracket, where even so, New Horizon is very close to that now. I think they're around 32,000 or something miles an hour in relationship to the sun. Roughly 8,000 miles slower once it gets out to AU 100. Get out to that area, and then if you compare where Voyager was at 100 AU, and you compare New Horizon, New Horizon will be 8,000 miles an hour slower. And that's based on, you know, New Horizon didn't get the boost from Saturn and at all, you know, just from Jupiter. Back to you, Dave.
What roughly was the launch velocity when the burn near Earth ended on New Horizons? So when New Horizons was being boosted by first, second, and third stage, I guess, and the last burn near Earth took place, what roughly was that velocity? Are we talking about numbers like 70,000, 80,000 miles an hour, Paul?
I don't know. I know, what is it, 25,000 miles per hour is the escape velocity. That's what all the Apollos had to do, 7 miles a second to go to translunar orbit. So they eventually started slowing down. I mean, they got to the point where between, you know, when the gravitational pull was lost from the Earth and the Moon started picking them up, they were going 4,000 miles per hour away from Earth. You know, they slowed down quite a bit. And the same thing happened to New Horizons. And it's So, you know, I'm trying to get, trying to figure it out. I think the best thing to do is you try to figure out the distance between here and the moon, which is roughly a quarter of a million or 225,000 miles. And you can take that and divide that by 9 hours, because that's how long it took. So that'll give us our speed. In fact, you're an engineer. You probably pull that number out of your head. I got to go to a calculator.
Yeah, if I take 240,000 miles to the moon divided by 9 hours, I end up with almost 27,000 miles an hour. That sounds like too low a number. Oh, maybe that's... I think you said it got to the moon in 9 hours, past the moon's orbit in 9 hours. But some of the time was boosting time. Some of the time may have been parking orbit time. I am guessing that it may not have been just a pure boost. Was there a boost to parking orbit, a little bit of study, and then the rest of the boost? But you were boosting during some of that time. So 9 hours, 240,000 miles, that's only 27,000 miles an hour. That's not big enough, as I see it. And it's interesting how this velocity and distance plays forward and backwards. Earth escape velocity, 7 miles per second, something like 25,000 miles an hour. You got to be moving that fast. You're not going to escape the Earth. If I took a particle way out in space and slowly released it and let it fall to the Earth, as it hit the Earth, it would be moving 25,000 miles an hour. Well, Voyager is out there near Pluto. I am guessing it's moving something like 30,000 miles an hour. So if I did the problem reverse, launch something at 30,000 miles an hour toward the Earth from Pluto, as it approached the Earth, that would be the velocity the rocket gave it as it took off. So I think I'll solve the problem backwards that way a little bit later on, because I think we're coming up with a number a little bit too low here, Paul. WS2N, K2RW.
Yeah, I know. And, see, now, Juno was launched with that's the one on the way to Jupiter. The same configuration. It was 551 M. Is the diameter of the fairing. The first five is, you know, meters, so it's, you know, call it 5 meters in diameter. And then how many boosters were attached to it. So that's the biggest, you know, Atlas could do. But that's the heaviest spacecraft. And so to have a slower launch velocity then. It was pretty quick. And New Horizons didn't go into orbit where, you know, Juno did a loop around the sun and came back to Earth and used Earth as a gravity assist. New Horizons, they just blasted the heck out of you in one shot, you know. Didn't go into a parking orbit. It just went out toward Mars and picked up a lot of speed from Jupiter, ran a lot of tests of all the 7 pieces of equipment at Jupiter. Beautiful pictures that came back from that, you know. I can see the difference between the Galileo pictures and the Horizon pictures, you know. Big difference. And you're going to even see a similar type of high quality once Juno gets into the polar orbit of Jupiter, and that's next year. We'll be following that in 2016, so a lot of things happening. 2016, you're going to have a launch, another launch to Mars with the InSight mission. That's the one that's going to drill a hole into Mars 15 feet deep into the ground. That I got to say, must have some diamond tip on that thing. A lot of interesting flights coming up. Dick, back to you.
But since Pluto is going to be the center stage this coming Tuesday of everybody's interest, I think what they're seeing so far is that the lower one-third of Pluto has got a great big dark patch in the southern hemisphere. I've forgotten how fast Pluto rotates, but I think they've seen that dark patch come around a couple of times. I believe it's got five moons.
9-hour rotation, I think.
Okay, 9-hour rotation. I think it's got 5 moons. I think somebody is predicting that we're going to see some geysers of some kind on the surface, even though the surface is so extremely cold, methane geyser or something like that. You've kept your ear pretty close to the ground on this operation, Paul. Make a couple of guesses. As New Horizons goes whizzing by Pluto, 7,500 miles away, I think is the number, what kind of surface do you think they're going to see? What kind of geysers or what else are you going to see? There's going to be unusual things on the surface of Pluto. There's going to be unusual things on the surface of those 5 moons. Make a couple of guesses, Paul. What do you think we're going to see that's going to be kind of exciting? WS2N with his crystal ball operating, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Because it's out around the Neptune area, you have a moon going around Neptune called Triton. And Voyager, when they went past Triton, saw nitrogen geysers coming out of that moon. Black streaks. They looked like black streaks along the surface. And then they figured out what it was. It was geysers of nitrogen, frozen nitrogen, coming out of the surface. So maybe I think that's where they're getting at. They're expecting, you know, maybe a similar type of atmosphere also in the Pluto. The Pluto, they know, has an atmosphere. So it's going to be interesting to see if that comes true. There's the dark area on the bottom, they're calling it a whale. It looks like a whole, you know, from one end of the planet to the other, you know, on that one side. It looks like a dark whale. They're calling that a whale. And then to the right of that, there's a big heart. And you're going to get details. Hopefully it's 7,000, a little over 7,000 miles above the surface. Let me drop it. Like you said, I think it's around 7,000. I think you're right, around 7,500 or 7,800 or something. But you got to remember, this thing's going past, let's call it 30,000, I think it's 31,000 miles, something like that, per hour. So, you know, at that height, you know, I think about our GPS satellites at 11,000 miles per hour around the Earth, how long they linger. You know, not too much in one space. You know, that's why you need dozens and dozens of GPS satellites flying around. You can't cover the whole Earth. So this thing's going to whiz by in like 15 minutes. You know, you're going to look at one side and look at the other side. The good thing about, you know, the way they have this whole set up is that the moon of Charon will kind of like be on the other side. And that's going to reflect light from the sun. So they'll be able to see both sides of Pluto. Let me drop it. You know, just like we have Earth's shine here, lighting up the part of the Earth, they're going to have, you know, their moon shine, shining the dark part of Pluto up. So, you know, it's all in the timing. They knew where the moon was going to be. And yeah, they do have 5 moons. And the moons are tilted in the orbit. You know, it's not along the plane, the equatorial plane, like Mars is. The moons of Mars or our moon is, you know, close to the equatorial plane. This thing, I don't know, looks like about an 80-degree offset. So New Horizon is coming in, looking at these 5 spinning objects around Pluto, using Pluto as the center of it, like the bullseye, and you're looking at like a target. And they chose the location to come in, the reason they're 7,000 miles away and not, you know, 3,000, or, you know, they had to pick a number. The reason they're doing that, they're coming in at the same distance Charon, the moon, is from Pluto. So they're coming in at its orbit. Let me drop it. WS2N. They plan on that because they know the moon going around Pluto has cleared its area. Over the billions of years this thing's going around, the planet has cleared that area. So you know it's a safe track to come through it. You don't want to come through it 30,000 miles an hour and hit a pebble. It'll take out the whole spacecraft. So that they chose that. It's amazing what they think about before they send these spacecraft out. And at the time when it was launched, Pluto was a planet. It only had one moon. They didn't know it had all these other moons. 10 years ago, time marches on, and things change in that period. And what are they going to see? Well, I don't know. We're going to wait and find out. I got another day, so back to you, Dick.
Good stuff. So they don't want to go any closer for fear of being hit by something. I suspect that some people believe that Pluto was not part of the original disk of material circling the sun, that at the time the sun was coalescing and forming, and later on the planets formed, that Pluto might not have been part of that original material, that Pluto may have been captured from some other place, particularly because its plane of orbit is so far tilted compared to the rest of our planets. Then again, the plane of orbits all line up into the so-called equatorial plane, the ecliptic plane, because of the interaction, I suspect, of them with each other. Pluto being so far out, didn't get a chance to do as much interacting. And the crazy orbit of Pluto is elliptical enough that it goes inside of the orbit of Neptune. So it's a really crazy tilted orbit, a lot more elliptical. It has some properties that look like it could have been captured. I'm trying to remember now, was it Saturn, Jupiter, Uranus? One of those planets has a moon going around the planet in the wrong direction. Almost like
Triton.
Okay, Triton is going around which planet, and it's going in the wrong direction. How in the world did they explain that one, Paul?
Yeah, they think. Let me see if I have it. They think that Triton, the moon, biggest moon of Neptune, was part of the Kuiper Belt, and it got captured by the same effect that a lot of these moons have gotten caught up by, but the direction that it came in from happened to be a different kind of an angle. And when it went past Neptune, it wound up going in the opposite direction. So, that's the thing. A lot of people say, well, Pluto's got demoted to a dwarf planet and all, but they found out that this Kuiper Belt has even more stuff out there than the asteroid belt. The asteroid belt being between Mars and Jupiter. So they're saying that Pluto is now the king of the Kuiper Belt and all those different things that they found out there. And some people even think that they might even find an Earth-sized planet due to the motions of Eris and Sedna, other Kuiper Belt objects that they. So Triton, bring up pictures of Triton. It's a strange looking place. I mean, one side is very bright, the other side is very dark. How did that all happen? Back to you, Dick.
Very true, Dick. Go ahead, Eric. I just wanted to let you know, if you turn your TV set on, anything back to normal now. The problem was actually at my TV station. Whoa. So for X number of hours, a good fraction of a day, there was an error at your TV station. Oh, I thought those errors are very rare, Eric. I thought there was almost no pilot error there.
Well, there is no pilot error. It's a piece of equipment that loses its mind because it's run by a computer.
So from the really goof up, it requires a human. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, it's called firmware. It's actually a weight in a box, which is used to measure Nielsen ratings. The stream passes through there. It actually adds some stuff to it and picks a little bit of it apart, but it didn't put it back together right.
Is there enough audit trail data in your method of investigating that you can find out roughly how long ago the event occurred, Eric? I mean, has that condition existed for 2 hours or 20 hours, so to speak? Over to you, Eric.
No, you actually gave me the first clue. You said sometime this morning, didn't you?
Yeah, I keep crazy hours, so the word morning has got some funny meanings. I vaguely remember a 2 a.m. of the previous day. And so many people probably don't know it. When you've got an automatic scan receiver and you tell it to go to channel 21, it thinks you want 21-1. And if there's nothing on 21-1 and 21-2, it goes and looks for 21-3. And so the average viewer with a more automated converter probably never knew the difference. Mine's got a memory that I go to, and when I ask it to go to 21-1, it goes to 21-1, and it told me there's plenty of carrier, but there was no electronic programming guide, and I could easily see there was no audio and video. I wasn't smart enough to dial in a 21-4-5 and 21-3-4-5. I do remember my memory selection of 21-3 had nothing. And so I should have tried 4-5. And according to Joe, there was no 6. So how did 3 levels of programming occur? A little bit mysterious. So is there enough order trail you can find out roughly when it happened, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't bother to look, but I'm going to look in the morning. You know, hasn't been screwed up for 24 hours. But see, the thing is, with the cable systems, as most people, as you know, get it from your cable or satellite, the feed that was feeding them was also messed up, except that they don't use the information that your TV set needs. Actually, the audio and video were there, and the assignments were completely wrong, so even if you did tuned earlier to 21-4-5 and 6, you still got nothing. It wasn't until I made that first phone call that somebody tried to do something about it.
Now, let's see if I understand what you just told me. For the person who's watching satellite television or cable television, did he have 21-1, 2, and 3? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, but they don't use 21-1, 2, and 3. They use 21 and 171 or 172 for cablevision, I think. On DirecTV, it's 21 and 4-something-something and 5-something-something to create. What they do is they just look, they actually don't even look. We tell them what the PID assignments are for the video and audio streams, and they just pluck them off. They don't take our guide. They don't take anything. They just pluck off the audio and the video stream. So the rest of the infrastructure around it can drop dead, and they're still getting it.
Interesting. I think I told you that I thought I had an error in my converter because for a period of time, about 4 months ago, 3 months ago, 11-1, 11-2 and 11-3, audio and video were beautiful. 11-1 and 2 had no electronic programming guide. 11-3 had the electronic programming guide of 11-1. 11-4 had the programming guide of 11-2. Everything was shifted by 2. And then there was a phony channel I could go to. Let's see, 11-1, 2, and 3. I could go to 11-4. And C2, and I was looking for an 11-5 to see if I could see the programming guide of 11-3. I couldn't get my machine to go to 11-5. So I remember bringing that to your attention, and all of a sudden, a day later, it disappeared. I was in that condition for like 2 months. I told you, and a day later it disappeared. Did you have anything to do with that, or is that a pure coincidence? Just telling you made it go away. Over to you, Eric, KTRIW.
How long ago was it?
I try to remember. I'd say roughly 2 to 3 months ago, Eric. Right now I'm not sure. Go ahead.
No, I remember talking to somebody there. I think it was like about 3 or 4 months ago. It's possible that I mentioned it and then they did something about it. The receivers generally won't mess that up. And by the way the guys come, they're not really associated with the channel. It's just another PID. The PID number is associated with the guide. If they don't send the right information out saying that this PID number is associated with that channel, and that's the what they call EPG, or Electronic Program Guide, and they have something called an EPT, an extended timetable, which gives you the description if they choose to send it. A lot of times you'll just see the name of the program and no information about it, and on some other channels they actually go through the trouble of sending the extended text, and then you get the description of the program and who's in it.
For a couple of years now, I was always getting the electronic programming guide on channel 31 for now a solid month. There is no electronic programming guide for channel 31-1, 2, and 3. This is a similar problem that nobody reported it to them, and something unique about my system falls into the trap. Over to you, Eric.
Well, right at this second, I can't answer that question. I have to go look and see. But I'm at the TV station right now. I actually just closed the gate. Standing here talking to you. But when I get home, I'll take a look. I mean, it could be your TV, but I kind of doubt it.
WS2N, just a question. Dick, I'm getting a programming guide on 31-1 right now.
Oh, got that. So maybe it's me. Go ahead, Paul.
I don't know if Eric gets involved with programming. I'm just wondering if Nova, they do such a good job on everything. I wonder if they're going to have a special on this Pluto encounter.
You've got it, Eric. That's going to be a beauty when Frontier, when Nova comes out with that one.
I know the Discovery, the Science Channel. The Science Channel is doing the live Pluto flyby. I know there's something in the works for Nova, I just don't know when.
When Nova does something, it's just fabulous. So I always record that. All right, back to you, Dick.
Eric, do most of those Novas come out of Boston?
They all come out of GBH in Boston.
When you say they all, meaning Nova, when it comes to much of the unique programming of PBS, I think you're saying Boston is one of the big producers. I'll bet you there's a couple of other centers around the United States that produce some of the PBS programming that's unique to PBS. Go ahead.
Hi. Look, for a long time, WNET was the flagship station of PBS. They still call themselves that. PBS calls themselves that. Four major suppliers of programming for PBS. WNET is one of them. We do great performances, major, a whole bunch of kids' shows, The American Experience. We do a lot of co-production with the WGA in Washington. So, like all the Ken Burns films and that kind of stuff, the News Hour. Actually, we do the News Hour weekend, and they do the News Hour weekly down at Weider in Washington. The other major supplier is WGBH. They do Frontline. They do Nova. There's a whole bunch of other things. A lot of cooking shows come from there. Home Time comes out of Chicago or Illinois. The Antiques Roadshow comes out of GBH. It's a whole lot of stuff, just like we do a whole lot of stuff. And then there used to be a station in L.A. that was PBS, but they decided to unjoin. They didn't want to pay the rates, so some shows like Tavis Smiley came out of there, but we took over production of it because they went out of that business. Control WKE2J.
I was about to ask you, are some of the PBS programs produced in California? Albert Smiley is, I think, a California guy. I think he lives there. Is there no longer a PBS channel in the Los Angeles or the San Francisco or the San Diego area? Is there no longer a PBS channel out there, or are they just not generating programming out there? Over to you, Eric.
Well, it just so happens that the Los Angeles station that unjoined PBS, they went independent. They're still a non-profit public station, but they're just not members of the public broadcasting system. But fortunately for Los Angeles, there were two PBS stations. Now there's only one. The San Francisco station is still in San Francisco. The San Diego station is still in San Diego. The Sacramento station is still there. There's one up in Santa Rosa. That's still active. So, but they were a big station, but the people that came in and became the chairman of their board and convinced a lot of people that they ought not to give PBS the $3 million membership and pay for the programming. So they're having a hard time filling up their broadcast day, I'll tell you that. KTYWK to Jack.
It sounds like it's almost as difficult a problem if you and I wanted to make our own local power generating station and make it profitable. Not easy. Is any of the PBS programming being produced in the state of California? Over to you, Eric.
Oh, there's quite a considerable amount of stuff that comes out of the West Coast, including Washington. Washington's a pretty big station. Actually, if you remember Bill Nye, the science guy, that came out of Seattle. They're a pretty big station up there. They produce a good chunk, but I don't think they produce more than like 6 or 7% of what is on the network. So, I mean, there's contributors from everywhere. Maryland Public Television, Mississippi Public Television, TV, which is out of South Carolina. So there's lots of production in lots of different places, but when you figure you've got 7 days a week with 24-hour day of programming, that's a lot of programming, you know.
One more question. Wonder what ever happened to Bill Baker, Dick? I may use the check-in.
You got it, Eric.
Dr. Bill is a media professor at St. John's in the city.
Media professor. K1BKR, I remember. I think are his call letters. BKR standing for Baker. I think he still has that ham license. I could look him up. And so, media professor. He also wrote a book. Why can't I think of the name of the book? Up to something or other.
Down to two. She wrote a number of books. That's just one of them.
Give me a name of some of the others. And I presume these are all books on the subject of the broadcasting industry.
I get it. Down to two was his experience from, you know, being, you know, literally CEO at Westinghouse and his travels through CBS and a lot of history of how even WNET came to being as a way to keep the competition out of the New York metro area. It's W1BKR, and you can find him every morning at, 87.55, I think, you know, on 80, early morning before the band fades out.
He gave up being president then, is that correct?
Well, let's put it this way. We're run by a governing board. And this governing board is made up of CEOs of big name companies. And was somebody else that kind of like used their influence and decided it was time to change the guard.
I always thought, you know, he put on, he was instrumental in putting those shows on. Maybe he wasn't, but terrific. And there's something about the sound in PBS or over-the-air broadcast. The sound is just better than cable. I don't know if you've ever been told that. Not so much just PBS, just anything that comes through my antenna. the quality, I just think it's phenomenal.